Hello and welcome to Marching On. I'm Micah Kubik, Executive Director of the ACLU of Kansas, and I thank you for joining us. It's election season in Kansas and across America, and so this is a good time to remember that many of the decisions that have the biggest impact on voter access and voting rights are not made in Washington, D.C., or even in the state capitol, but are instead made at the local level, the county level. Now, at the ACLU, we love voting rights and we love voting access. So it has been one of our ongoing missions over the years to equip Kansans with information on decisions that their county makes about voting. We're telling them how their county stacks up in making voting accessible. One of the most important ways that we do this is through our All Democracy is Local report, which debuted in 2018, got a follow-up in 2023, and now, I'm very excited to share, just got its newest update. So our first conversation on today's episode is a look at this report with the people who led the efforts to research and produce it. Our communications director, Esmeet Sung, discusses what we found out about the state of voting access at the local level with Logan DeMond, director of policy and research, and Kayla Curry, research and data manager here at the ACLU of Kansas. In the back half of the episode, we have an exciting project to share with you. We invited a slew of Kansas voters to share their motivations for voting and to help make voting accessible for every eligible person. What better way to celebrate the spirit of democracy during this 250th anniversary of the country than by hearing from the voters who helped make it special? So stick around for that segment. But first, let's toss it to Logan, Kayla, and Esme to talk about how all democracy is local.
Logan, Kayla, thank you so much for joining to share more about this latest report from the ACLU of Kansas. This is the third iteration of this report. So we did our first All Democracy is Local report back in 2018. And then we also published All Democracy is Still Local in 2023. So Logan, to me, the obvious place for us to start is 3 years later. Why make this report now?
Well, in the 3 years since the last iteration of All Democracy is Local, we've seen an unprecedented number of attacks on voting rights, not only at the federal level, but also at the state level, right here in Kansas. This report is timely in pointing out those attacks, but also pointing out that local election officials have the power to safeguard elections and proactively implement policies that do so.
So we've done multiple iterations of this report, right? So we kind of knew going in what to expect. But this is the first report that we've done that covers a presidential election year. And it's also a historic year for the state of Kansas. There were more Kansans than ever to actually cast a vote in that year. So that's really important context to add for this report as well.
And so Kayla, I know you were really in the weeds gathering and analyzing the data across Kansas's 105 counties. That's no small feat. So could you maybe give us a big picture view on the methodology behind the production of the report and really if there was anything about the process that surprised you?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it was a big process. There are 105 counties in Kansas, so that meant we were sending out individual core requests to all 105 counties to be included in the sample. There was a lot of back and forth, a lot of hounding of county election officials to respond. But we ended up getting 101 out of the 105 counties in Kansas to respond. So Jewell, Osage, Stafford, and Woodson counties are the counties you're not going to see in the report. But we were able to get the big ones and the most populous counties. And I think with a sample this large, it makes all the findings in the report even more compelling.
That's such helpful context on how the report was created. Logan, I'm going to turn to you. What were the major findings of the report?
An overarching theme in this report, folks in Kansas want to vote, but barriers remain. Building on the last iteration of this report, we found that the number of voters assigned to a polling place directly affects turnout. So when more voters are assigned to an individual polling place, it's going to have a negative effect on turnout at that location. We need more polling places, not just on election day, but more early voting opportunities as well. We also found that mail-in voting remains incredibly popular in Kansas. We found that accessibility remains an issue across the state and that there's inconsistency from county to county.
That's a really helpful overview. Kayla, let's dig into the data a little bit. So I want to open it up to you. What actually jumped out the most to you while you were preparing the report and sifting through all that data?
I think the biggest thing for me was looking at how much variance there was in the answers from the counties. Obviously, we have state-level statutes and guidelines that are given to each county election office that they're supposed to follow. But we do see that there are some counties that do better than others or aren't living up to the standards they should be. And that variance really tells us what we've been trying to say for the past iterations of this report, that all democracy is local. Local election officials have a lot of authority over how they administer elections. And your experience as a voter at the poll is largely determined not by state level or federal level legislation, but how your local county election offices has decided to administer the election process. So we really think that it's on county election officials to use that power in a positive way to implement and expand policies that make voting easy and accessible for all eligible voters.
That actually gives me a really good starting point to zoom in a little on the mail-in hotspots chart in the report. I thought that was really interesting. So how do you define a hotspot in this context? And how did you decide which counties to include in that chart?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. This is actually a new measure that we haven't really looked at in the past reports. And the reason we kind of wanted to talk about it, first of all, is last legislative session in 2025, we saw the repeal of the 3-day mail processing window, which means that before, voters could cast their vote and their ballot would be accepted by mail up to 3 days after Election Day, as long as it was postmarked by Election Day at 7 p.m. That's no longer the case, which has the potential to disenfranchise a lot of voters. So we were interested to see where in Kansas is mail-in voting super popular. So we looked at counties and what are the proportions of mail-in ballots out of the total ballots cast in that county. The sample average was around 8%. So all hotspots were any places where the proportion of mail-in ballots were one standard deviation or 3% above that sample average. And what we saw were 8 hotspots. 6 of those had turnouts that were higher than the state turnout. So what that tells us is that mail-in voting is a popular method of voting, and that really urban counties, rural counties, and counties of all different kinds are using this as a method of voting. And there's also existing research out there that shows that progressive mail-in voting policies do correlate with higher turnout. Unfortunately, there was only 4 counties that were proactive about sending out mail-in ballots, and these counties did have higher turnout. Obviously, this is not causation in any way, but it does show that proactive voter turnout, especially when it comes to mail-in voting, really does have an association with voter engagement.
That's really helpful context. And then, of course, we had the SCOTUS decision this week that supported a 5-day mail processing period in Mississippi. So that tells us that the Kansas period could be reinstituted, it sounds like. Is that y'all's position? Or?
Absolutely. And we make the strong recommendation in this report we will continue to lobby for during legislative session. We would encourage local election officials to lobby state legislators to reinstate the 3-day mail processing period,
which, as we know, is really important for folks who've done everything right to cast a ballot. So one other focus of the report I really want to look at, and something that we've been working on, right, is the translation of voting materials. So this has been a priority for us at the ACLU of Kansas the past couple of years in Johnson and Wyandotte counties. I'm really curious the conclusions you found from this report and the data across the state when it comes to how different counties serve voters who may not speak English as their first language.
It's important to note that we're not talking about this narrative that individuals will spin about non-citizen or illegitimate voting. We're talking about individuals who have taken all the necessary steps on the path to citizenship, might not speak English as their primary language. We're also talking about folks who just speak a language other than English as their primary language. So I would encourage folks to put themselves in their shoes. Think about the barriers to the ballot, not just at the ballot box themselves, where we know language on the ballot is confusing. It's meant to trip you up. We're also talking about all the steps before that, all the information you receive from your county election official, information about early voting locations, information about the right to receive language assistance at the polls, information about your polling place. If all of that is communicated in English, think about the barriers that presents to these thousands of individuals across Kansas.
I'd also like to point out that this isn't a small population. There are over 170,000 voting-age citizens in Kansas who speak a language other than English. So we're not talking about a really small proportion of the population, but a pretty large swath of the voting population.
Yeah, I think it's really helpful, too, to think that we're not necessarily talking about people who don't speak English at all, right? Like, we're already saying this is confusing, and sometimes it is just easier to read things in your first language. So I think that's such a great point, Logan. Kayla, I also want to talk about early voting, which is such a focus within the report, but also really important across the state. We really had this come into the spotlight in Johnson County, which went from 18 to 12 early voting locations almost overnight at the snap of one person's fingers. So what does the report tell us about the relationship between early voting for Kansans and how we've seen that play out and who casts the ballot and how many people cast the ballot?
Early voting is one of the most popular methods of voting in Kansas. In the 2024 general election, over 40% of all the votes cast were early in-person votes. And in the context of the attacks from the state level and even at the federal level, early voting is something that we mentioned in the report a lot as something to be protected. And local election officials do have a lot of power over that. They get to decide how many early voting locations are open, what hours are offered, what days are offered for those early voting locations. And for a lot of populations, people who are working multiple jobs or have irregular hours, childcare responsibilities, transportation barriers, things like that, early voting presents more accessible opportunities for voting. And for some people, it's the only way they can cast a vote at all. So we make recommendations in this report about expanding early voting locations, making sure that there is geographical diversity in where those polling locations are so that these are accessible to the most amount of people. And also making sure that the hours that are offered outside of just the 9-to-5 business hours. That seemed to be the biggest factor in terms of early voting that we saw correlated to higher turnout. So the counties that did have more hours outside of business hours on average saw higher turnout.
And we want higher turnout.
And that's what we want.
Thank you for touching on these really important findings in the report. Logan, I do want to circle back to you to help bring this together. So with everything this report covers, what are some of the conclusions and recommendations that the ACLU of Kansas makes for election officials in our state?
We can really break up the recommendations into three distinct categories. As Kayla just mentioned, early voting opportunities remain critical to higher turnout in Kansas, not just making sure we have more and geographically diverse locations, early voting locations, but also the number of locations in each county, making sure we have accessible hours outside of traditional working hours, making sure that we're meeting the needs of voters where they're at. Second, talking about mail-in voting. When we talk about this, we're not just talking about the attacks in the legislature. We know those will continue. Just this year, they tried to repeal mail-in voting altogether, and we know they'll try and do it again, right? So it's up to us to lobby our legislators, ask them to reinstate the 3-day mail processing window, and also apply pressure on our county election officials to do the same thing, to lobby their legislators, knowing the impact this has on election administration, making sure we safeguard mail-in voting opportunities, implementing automatic mail-in ballots for everyone. And then the third category is accessibility. And we're not just talking physical limitations to accessing the polls. We're talking actual practices at the polling places, making sure election workers know what services should be offered, making sure there's uniformity across counties, and also making sure we expand access in terms of language access and translated materials.
Thank you both so much. I think that really tells our listeners what to look for. And we obviously encourage everyone to check out the report at aclukansas.org.
And now let's throw it to communications manager Jesse Kielman to introduce our special project featuring the voices of Kansas voters.
I'm probably not the first person to tell you that 2026 is a crucial election year. I know I'm not the first person. If you've been following the ACLU of Kansas channels, Mike has been sharing this with anybody in earshot. Because of this, we wanted to do a special project celebrating democracy and spreading enthusiasm for making your voice heard through voting. To do this, we teamed up with Boots on the Ground Midwest, and I got to meet the organization's co-founders, Martha and Nancy.
My name is Martha Lawrence. I'm co-founder of Boots on the Ground Midwest.
And I'm Nancy Mays, and I co-founded it with Martha.
And Boots on the Ground is a grassroots advocate organization. We're part of Indivisible, but we are nonpartisan and work in both Kansas and Missouri. Major part of our work is in Johnson County, and we work to make sure that elections are fair and people are treated well, and we are just defending democracy every day.
Yep. And a lot of what we do started out of, you know, folks being angry and wanting to resist authoritarianism. And our goal is always, how do we turn that into action? Like, how do we make our rage actions that will help make our community better?
How do you feel about voting?
It's shockingly, we're very anti-voting.
It's the one exception to the rule.
Exactly. I mean,
so much of the actions that we take and the focus that we have would get better if people voted and they voted their values. And so the more people we can get to vote, the more people we can get to look at what their values are and how to support elected officials that actually reflect the values of Kansans, the better we're all going to be and the less work we'll have to do to save democracy.
Right.
And in a nutshell, that's the spirit of this project, highlighting Kansas values and the way we make those heard through voting. But we know that the ways we experience our values and the way we learned about civic engagement can have similarities, but they can have differences. So for this project, I interviewed a full slate of Kansas voters. Now, as a reminder, the ACLU of Kansas is a nonpartisan nonprofit, and the views expressed by individuals are their own. That said, it was important for me to allow them to share their viewpoints in their own words. One of the things I found interesting was how differently people's relationships with voting began and how the way they evolved from there was so personal. Here's me asking about this with Judy and Alan. Where did your relationship with the idea of being a voter start?
Well, for me, I think a lot of it came through some of my high school education. There was somebody in my high school social studies or civic education that really made an impression on me that your vote makes a difference.
Well, that occurred for me, too. Actually, I remember it from my junior high days. There was a major national election. We followed the election. We had classroom debates and all of that. But as far as voting being modeled for me very early in life, I remember as a small child, my parents loading my sister and me in the backseat of the car because they drove the few miles to the vacant rural one-room schoolhouse that was a local polling place. And I remember going like, but what is this all about? And they explained to me, well, this is where we go to vote. This is the polling place.
I knew voting was important. I don't think I understood the local politics and the local system that had such an impact on day-to-day life until I was a parent, probably, and I cared about schools, and I cared about the roads and safety and just having a community that cared about the person who didn't have what I had. And why was that, and how can my vote change that? So it was more as an adult, I think, for me. So
I think I learned a lot of that as a kid. I grew up in a small community, and so I knew who our local community leaders were. I mean, they were the people next door, and I knew who our county commissioners were. They were the people next door, and I learned what these people did.
But many others had their own stories to tell.
My name is Margaret Howison. My parents were voters, and they encouraged me and my sister to vote as soon as we could. I've always felt it was important to be a participant in the system that allows us to have our say.
I'm Linda McSullen, and voting is really important to me. It's important especially for a person like myself who is African American. My mother worked at the voting polls every year. I remember that. That stuck in my head. But to be honest, I never really voted until I met the man I'm married to today. It just wasn't something talked about. So once we got together, I started understanding the importance of it. If I don't understand history and where my ancestors have dealt with and what they had to go through, I'm not going to understand it enough to understand the importance of it.
I'm Olivia. I'm 23 years old. I am a resident of Overland Park, Kansas. I come from a family where my mother particularly was very passionate about voting and being publicly involved. It is a passion that I have grown into more coming into my own adulthood. So the first vote that I ever cast was the 2022 primaries when we were looking to codify the right to abortion in the Kansas Constitution. And that was a moment that was really personal for me. That I, you know, even as a young 19-year-old, that I was able to have a voice in what happens, you know, with my body and with other people's bodies in my community.
I'm Rob Patton. My parents were always first at the polls, first in line.
I'm Donna Patton, and I guess I've just always thought it was really important to vote. In 1964, I wasn't quite old enough to vote, so I missed voting by just a few days, which was a real bummer. And then in 1968, we had moved and I had to satisfy the residency requirement. So I didn't get to vote then either. So when I finally got to vote in 1972, which I know is a long time ago, I was really excited to do that.
We are a country that is based upon citizen participation. We're going to fall back into oligarchies and all this sort of stuff. And I think from my study of the American Revolution, I think Tom Jefferson and Ben Franklin, they all would be appalled that we would even think about going back.
My name's Pat Devine. I'm retired, and voting has always been important to me. We grew up in a household where we talked not ultra politics, but the news of the day. It was in the 60s, and that's when both Vietnam and racial issues were on the front page and in the news every evening. And so we were very aware of what the events were of the day and that we should have an opinion about it.
My name is Roseanne Rosen. Yeah, my father escaped Nazi Germany in 1938, and he was a firsthand witness. He was 16, and a firsthand witness to what happens when democracy and the right to vote, the right to free speech is taken away. If you look at what happened in 1933 in Germany, there's so much that's happening now. I think it's just the language being used for people that might be less than or considered less than.
If you think there are through lines from our political climate to the authoritarian Nazi regime, you're not alone. A historian of that period agrees. I'll let her introduce herself.
My name is Shelley Klein. I am a historian. I'm a historian of modern Europe, actually. So I understand very clearly what happens when you aren't engaged in your political system.
Any bad examples from that?
Yeah. The one or two come to mind. The Holocaust is my specialty. So,
oh, wow.
The Holocaust in Nazi Germany is my specialty. So as a kid, my parents always voted. Like, they came home. My mom was a kindergarten teacher. My dad's a farmer. They'd come home with their I voted sticker. So it was something that I always saw as a part of my childhood growing up. We didn't talk about it, though. We didn't talk about why you vote or why it's important. It's just something we did. And then when I got to college, I had a college professor who was very influential in my life. And she said the history of our great republic is living up to our founding ideals, and voting is the way that we get to participate in that process. And so that was maybe the first time it was really articulated to me about my responsibility in all of it. And then, of course, as I became a historian, I saw all the more clearly what happens when you don't and when you are not engaged and when you just don't care. That's when the bad things can really set in. We always talk about Nazi Germany. And we look at the republic that preceded it as a complete disaster. Like, it was too liberal and it was just built to fail. But really, it was the most liberal democracy the world had seen. And it did a lot of really incredible things. And there were rights that were won during that time that I'm sure people thought, oh, we've achieved it. They're here. They're guaranteed. The fight's over. And yet, in a matter of a few years, all of that was gone.
One of the ways Martha and Nancy want to evolve civic engagement and political rhetoric is to get underneath the labels we're accustomed to using and look more deeply at our values.
And I think that's an important point about voting your values. We're really trying to push people to think beyond party lines, because we get grounded into what are you? You know, are you this or are you that? In the same way, it's irrational in the same way that, you know, I support KU basketball and I hope K-State loses, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a rational thought, right?
Yeah.
And so we're trying to push people to think about what are your values and then how do you vote along those lines? And also, when we get people thinking about their values, then we can begin to make more systemic changes, because at the root of it, no single regime change or administration change is going to change everything. We need to think about the systems that are supporting, you know, corruption, racism, you know, misogyny, all those things. And so by talking about values, we can get there faster.
And by voting for those values,
yes,
we get there faster.
Absolutely.
And perhaps no one understands this better than Kara. Here was her response when I asked her how her relationship to voting has changed over time.
I was hoping you would ask this question. I was apolitical for 40 years of my life. My parents did not talk about voting. They did not talk about candidates. They did not talk about policy, economics. That was not part of our home. Whether they talked about it privately, I don't know, but it definitely wasn't part of our family conversation. I was raised in a town that's 80% white in a white evangelical church. And so I bought into the implicit bias from the beginning, and I was part of it for 40 years. And I think 10 years ago, I started to explore some paths that I'd never explored in my life. So I put myself in places that I'd never been. I started volunteering for organizations that were helping people on the ground, people that weren't like me. And my eyes opened and I was like, whoa, I've been duped my whole life. My whole life, these people have been out here needing help and I've just been skating around on my privilege. It felt gross all of a sudden. I didn't question anything. I didn't question anything that had been told to me. I didn't question any societal structures or societal norms. I said, oh, if I want to be accepted by society, this is who I have to be. And then when I started going through all the motions of seeing things from a different perspective, I started questioning everything.
Universally, one of the biggest frustrations was the ongoing attempts to make voting harder. Here's Janice.
Voting is harder right now because we're getting so many negative messages about voting. Our leaders are expressing that maybe the voting isn't fair. And so people may question that. They don't want to get up and go to the polls and think, well, this really doesn't count. And that's the problem. We have leaders that are really not being transparent and accepting that the U.S. citizens know what they're doing and can make good decisions about who they want to run the country.
And the idea of making voting easier and more accessible isn't abstract. People had a lot of thoughts on early voting and vote by mail, two initiatives to make voting easier and two initiatives both under attack here in Kansas and beyond right now.
Making sure that people have access to voting is really one of the most patriotic things that you can do, right? The fact that we have early voting makes it more accessible to folks. But once we start kind of, you know, corralling that, which is we're in a phase to do that right now, then we're back to voter suppression.
And vote by mail, because there's so many people that even if there's access to early voting, they are not able to go to a poll to vote.
Yeah.
Do we not want them to participate in society? Is that, have they somehow aged out or yeah, not worth it? No, we need to give them as much access as possible to be able to vote.
Yeah.
I think that it's very easy for people to assume that if it's easy to vote for them, it's easy to vote for everybody else. My mom had polio as a kid. So now she's almost 80 years old, and it is difficult for her to get in and out of buildings, especially if there is like inclement weather. So mail-in ballots are really essential to her. And my mom lives in a rural area of the state. So, you know, mail-in is important because so many people rely on being able to mail something in. So I was really disheartened to see that grace period taken away. And I think that if you're able-bodied, it's really easy to just forget about people who don't have that privilege of being able to walk into a space. The same thing about early voting. For those of us who have cars or we have flexible work schedules, of course we can vote on election day. But if you don't have those things, it makes it all the harder. So I think so many accessibility issues come back to people being unable to think about someone's lived experience that is different from their own. And we need to make sure that everybody has the same access if they're eligible to vote.
Mail-in voting in particular, I know that a lot of elderly folks vote by mail. But also, I mean, I've used it on a regular basis over the years just so I can early vote and mail in my ballot. And that was the easiest thing. Now I'm distrustful of it because they're minimizing the number of days that we have. And it may be that in this state, we'll only have a few locations to vote as well, because in Johnson County, at least, they've now eliminated 8 voting sites in the county. So that's very concerning to me as well.
You have to ask yourself, who benefits? Who benefits from fewer people voting? Who benefits from worse access to polling locations? Mm-hmm. Who is benefiting from that?
Right. And so why are folks, you know, working toward that?
And we know the answer.
Connie.
Margaret, Martha, and Nancy are alluding to the closure of several early voting locations ahead of the August 4th primary, which came abruptly and seemingly without purpose.
I think that there's no real defensible reason to take away that many sites, especially those on bus routes, those that impact students. I get if you want to kind of spread it out across the county, but it really seemed like these were very targeted to particular areas. And adding new sites, that's fantastic. But why did we have to take away 8 just to add 2? So it definitely feels like voter suppression to me. And again, it's an access issue. When you look at the places that were cut on bus routes, a lot of people, they didn't even notice that that was part of the issue. But you certainly noticed if you rely on public transportation to get to the polls.
All those voting places had been funded, so there was no reason to close them because of funding. We always voted at the community college, and it was great. It was easy. We could vote there. We could get in and out in 20 minutes. And it's one of the ones that was closed, which was disappointing.
When I initially heard that 8 early polling locations were going to be shut down in Johnson County, it created a lot of confusion and, again, kind of sparked that fear of why are these locations, especially that are concentrated by younger voting populations and more marginalized voting populations, being taken away without explanation. It feels like an attack on our ability to participate in the public sphere when we've seen that people are having less and less trust in elections, and that is frightening to me.
I actually reached out to Connie Schmidt several times that first week. She was on vacation. I didn't know. I have not received a response from her. I have not received a response from the Johnson County Election Office.
So within the window where I was doing these interviews, Connie Schmidt actually appeared at a boots on the ground meeting, appropriately enough. Erin was one of my later interviewees after the meeting, and she was in attendance. Here's what she had to say.
The reason that she gave us last night was like the locations to make them more equally spread across the county, which she said that they took early voters. She took our home address and the location where we tend to vote, and then looked at the locations, but there were no like work commute patterns considered, bus routes, notification of the voters that go to those locations that are now going to be closed. And a huge one is Johnson County Community College. Literally, one of the things that she said to us last night was she complained how hard it is to get the young people out to vote, that she has to remind her own grandchildren to register to vote when she's literally shutting down a huge voting site for young voters for early voting. So many times she mentioned that voters are creatures of habit and they go to their same location every time. And yet here she is shutting down 8 of those locations.
Still, closing these early polling sites are indicative of a much larger pattern.
It needs to be accessible to everyone in all circumstances, whether you're disabled, whether or not you have transportation. The participation as a citizen in our government, in our democracy, some of the events that are taking place now with the SAVE Act and other circumstances decreases that, makes it more exclusive instead of inclusive. My wife teaches citizenship class. And so people want to be able to vote. They want to be able to participate.
Why would we restrict somebody from voting? Why would we want them to not vote? I don't get it.
Well, I think the danger with erecting hurdles between people and voting is that those hurdles can be designed to be selective. And you're trying to influence the vote by putting up what looks might be a benign hurdle, but that hurdle is not benign. It's going to hurt some people more than others. It's totally unfair.
If we mean what we say when we say that every vote counts, if we want to have a community that represents all voices, all languages, and if we want to create change for communities who have historically and are currently being attacked and misrepresented, then I think it is crucial to have ballots be available in all the languages that are represented in our community.
Having language access in the polls for multiple languages is just as imperative as having access at all, because this country was built on people who speak different languages, who come from different cultures, who have made this country what it is. And so if you are immediately limiting people who can vote to only people that can speak one specific language, then you're cutting off a whole section of our country that makes us who we are.
Yeah. Everybody who is here and is a citizen deserves the right to vote and to have the materials in their language of origin.
If you make the language confusing, people don't understand and they don't know what they're voting for. So if you're reading it in a different language, you're certainly not going to understand what you're voting for.
So you need to know what you're voting for or against.
Again, I think that comes back to assuming everybody has the same lived experience, and that seems no reason why we, if possible, we shouldn't have materials available in another language, because again, that's about accessibility. I also, as a historian, I have reading knowledge of German, but the reading knowledge I have is certainly not bureaucratic German, right? So if I were presented with, hey, I've lived in Germany, I've had to fill out German paperwork, and I know that it is a very difficult level of reading. Plenty of people can probably function in their average lives. And then you get to, like, I could function in German society, but presented with my health insurance document, I don't know what that says, especially since a lot of the language is kind of meant to be confusing on some of the ballot issues. So I'm in full support of having language translations for accessibility.
Worked in healthcare administration for a long time, and so I'm familiar with how many languages healthcare materials are translated into. It's very common. Most hospitals have various materials in various languages. If we can do it in the healthcare system, we should be able to do it in the voting system as well.
I'm a native English speaker, and I sometimes struggle with understanding ballot issues. I can't imagine trying to do it in my second language. When we welcome people into our community and say, you have checked the boxes, gone through the process, and you are now a citizen of this country and you have the right to vote, that we have to make it accessible. It's a commitment on our part to that person that we have welcomed into our community to make it possible for them to vote.
When you make it easier for them to vote, you're reaching out and telling them, your opinion matters. You know, we want to hear from you.
That last voice was Marcia. Yes, we're still meeting new people. I talk to a lot of people. When reflecting on the way that voting protects our rights and creates our world, Marcia had an interesting story about her mom.
I'm old enough to remember when my mom got her first credit card and her first car in her own name, which she couldn't do. When she was growing up, she could not get a card. My aunt had to have my uncle co-sign for her in order to get her first apartment. And she was out of college and working as a teacher. Nobody would rent to her because she was a woman. So seeing those type of things make me want to vote, because I want to make sure that my daughters have it better than I did and have it better than my mom did. Other things that make me want to vote are that since I'm in healthcare, one of the things that frustrates me the most is the fact that with this current administration and the Republican Party, I cannot go to the CDC anymore, and I cannot go to the National Institute of Health anymore to get information I need to do my job as a pharmacist, because the information has been scrubbed from their websites, or the information that is being put out there is not valid, and you cannot confirm it.
For Marcia, this frustration at the consequences from past votes were foundational to her getting more involved going forward.
I did not want to feel helpless anymore, because everything that's been going on with the current administration has been frustrating and you feel powerless. So the one way I can take back a little bit of that power is to do something. And I decided that doing something locally would make more sense because it impacts the people I know.
I talked to one other woman who had an interesting story of her mom that spurred her into action. Also, I promise, this is the last of our new faces.
My name's Lisa Cooper, and I'm a native Kansas Cityan. One of the stories that's just personal to me, to my heart, is that after my mother passed away, I was downstairs in my parents' basement, and there was this old desk that had been down there for many decades because we weren't using it. And before I got rid of it, I thought, you know, I'm going to go through this, every little drawer, every little nook and cranny, and make sure there's not some treasure before I put it on the street. And so there was tucked in behind a drawer a paper my mother had written in high school, 1947, actually, about the importance of voting and the problems with voter apathy and the problem with, if you don't vote, you can't complain about something. And this is just in the aftermath of World War II. So now 80 years have gone by, and we're still facing the same problems in our country with just 60% of people are voting in presidential campaigns, you know, and I read, I think, 40% in the midterms. So it saddens me. I think it's disheartening that 80 years later, we have the same issues and we don't want history to repeat itself. And one of the reasons I'm passionate about voting is because I'm also a mom. And I think about my daughter, I think about future generations, and what we can do to ensure that we have a strong democracy.
I had started by asking people about the views they inherited about voting. But in many of these conversations, this steered towards conversations about the voting views they're wanting to pass down to the next generation.
I have a proud moment. Please. Because my parents, like I said, were not political. They didn't involve us anyway. When my daughter turned 18, I took her to vote. Like, she wanted to go, but I was like, hey, let's go together. And I just felt really proud of myself because I didn't have that example growing up. And I think that that is the example that more parents or guardians, adults need to share.
The issues change, the politicians change, but what doesn't change is our obligation to participate in the process. From an early age, I was taught that. From an early age, I taught my daughter that. I would bring her with me to stand there. I'd get her a little sticker, and that was so important. My mother-in-law, on the 18th birthday of every single one of her grandchildren, she took them to register to vote. Mm-hmm. So it's just a value that flies through all of our family and should be in everyone's family, and everybody should be doing it.
This is something that my daughter and I talk about when we go vote, because I take her with me to do early voting. And she's not old enough to vote yet. She's about to be 16. She and her friends are all going to be juniors in high school. And they are very excited to vote. They are very aware of what's going on now because they have friends and classmates that have been impacted negatively by state laws that have been passed and by national issues that are happening. So they see it and they don't like it. But we do the whole voting process that I was talking about together. We look at all the issues and the candidates. We research everybody. We talk about them, why I will or will not vote for them. We put together the cheat sheet that we take to voting. We vote. I vote. But, you know, we go through, this is why, this is how you do it. And then once you give them the ballot, the best part, we get our stickers. And, you know, she gets one too. And I can't remember what it says, but it's like future voter or something. Yeah. And I get mine that vote, and we wear them all day. And then when you see somebody else wearing them, you're like, okay, hi, I see you. But now that she knows and we talk about the issues, and it's not just some thing far away in this area that doesn't touch anybody. Like, no, these issues happen, and then they trickle down. And this is how this happened to your friend or your classmate or your teacher or your coach or this or that. Like, that's because people voted for this person or this issue. That's how it works, and it impacts you like this. And so now she's connected that, and thankfully a lot of kids her age have, and they see like, oh, this is how we have our power to change this. If we don't like what's going on here, if it's hurting people that we care about or us, this is how we can change it. It's really cool to hear them talk when they don't think you're listening, and they end up talking about this, and you're like,
yep. Did something right.
I'm speaking to the next generation. You are worthy to have a voice. Let your voice be heard.
And for what it's worth, the next generation seems to be in agreement. Not just on voting being important, but why. Listen to this through line, starting with 23-year-old Olivia.
Voting is something that feels almost sacred to me in a way. Just being able to express the desires that I have both for myself and my community is what voting means to me.
I'm looking at all the issues to make certain that it is going to help instead of harm myself, my family, and others. And it's unfortunate that we as a people don't understand the power that we really hold, because the power really is in our vote.
The older I get, the more I understand that elections at every level, very, very local up to general nationwide elections, in some way, they're going to affect your daily life. And not just my daily life, my neighbors, my kids, my husband, my community, my countrymen, like everybody is going to get affected.
And voting is important to me because it's caring. The way you care about other people is to vote, so that way you can make other people's lives better by getting policies and things that matter and change that matters.
We're now in a time where not caring and being uninvolved is no longer acceptable. Like, apathy isn't an option. Like, we're really at mission critical right now.
We have to treat people fairly, equally. And if they're a citizen, everyone has the right to vote. And we can't make it difficult. I think it's just everything that takes away, strips away our rights one by one. And soon we just are in a country we don't recognize.
But in order to protect those rights, you need to be able to have some level of participation. And voting is the universal. Everyone, man, woman, if you're 18 or older, you should have the right to vote and not be excluded from that opportunity.
If we're all showing up at the polls, that's when we get the best solutions. When we narrow the opportunities to vote, when we make it difficult for people to vote, we are losing out on opinions and perspectives that are important to making good decisions for all of us.
I think that also reflects in why people don't vote. Is, well, what difference does it make? Why am I not, these politicians don't represent me. They don't do what I need them to do. They don't represent my values. So what's the point of voting? When it should be the opposite, is that I want to vote for politicians, elected officials who will represent me and represent the values that we as a community have.
That's an excellent point, Martha. Thank you, Nancy.
There are so many people that want the best for everybody, and they're working very hard to accomplish that. It may not seem like they're as loud as the side that's trying to marginalize everybody and prop themselves up, but there are tons of us, way more than the other side. And I definitely believe that. And I see it with the people that I volunteer with and work with. And I see how important this is to everybody. The thing that we all have in common is that we can see the better. Like, we can see it coming. There are millions of people all over this country that know that it doesn't end like this. And everybody's working very hard to get it better for everybody, not just back to what it was, but to try to level the playing field for all populations of this country. So just keep going, because we'll make it happen.
Thank you to all of the voters who joined us for this project, and special thanks to our friends at Boots on the Ground for helping connect us with so many great voices. We also send our thanks to Logan, Kayla, and Esme for joining us to share their insights on the All Democracy is Local report. You can find that full report in all its detailed and helpful glory on our website, either under Reports in the header or by going directly to aclukansas.org/ADIL. Again, that's aclukansas.org/ADIL. When you check it out, pay special attention to the conclusions and recommendations section at the end, which, spoiler alert, advocates for common sense and meaningful steps like increasing early vote availability and offering multilingual resources. From there, you can also reach out to your local election official and encourage them to implement these common sense programs in your community. When voters make their voices heard, democracy wins. And that is especially true when communities advocate for voter access. That does it for this episode of Marching On. Tune in next month for more conversations with the people who are at the heart of the civil liberties movement here in Kansas. Until next time, keep marching on.